This is an ABC podcast.
Thank you, Ellen, and thank you, Carly, for sitting in the studio while I was sitting in my cell at Long Bay. And it's great to be out on bail in time to talk to Laura about Canberra politics, to Sarah Maslin about the election in Brazil, starring the Trump of the Tropics, and to Hilary Mantel about Thomas Cromwell. But first of all, Laura Tingle, has anything of importance happened while I was away?
Well, it'd depend on your definition of importance, I think, Philip. There was a death in the family, so to speak, and as a result, most other things stopped for a fortnight. So,
has Vlad been up to any nonsense?
Well, yes, that was actually reasonably significant. Vladimir Putin is obviously under a little bit of pressure and has been mobilising the Russian army for the first time since 1941, I think it might have been. It's not really going very well for him.
But there's good news from Italy, isn't there, because the fascists are back in power.
I'm shaking my head. I don't know if that really works on radio, Philip, but I'm just shaking my head.
Okay, now, did Albanese have any choice in following the protocols that were already in place in regard to what happened in the days and weeks following the royal death?
I think there's a bit of yes and no in that one, Philip. I think the logistics of this is a monstrously large amount of ceremony that we saw in the UK meant that there was a lot of obligation on him to just follow the timetable on dealing with and responding to the death of the Queen. I suspect that there might have been a little bit of regret or something within the government about agreeing to suspend Parliament. I suspect that was one of those things which was on the list of things to do, but people hadn't thought about, well, wait a minute, will the British Parliament be sitting? You know, when were we supposed to be sitting? Does it make any difference? And they're all being a bit defensive about it and saying, oh, well, it would have been sort of stupid just to come back for one day or 2 days. Well, it has been known to happen in the past. And, you know, we could have had the condolence motion rather than having them all come back last Friday. So I think probably if he had his time again, there'd be things that he wouldn't do exactly the same. But it has been pretty astonishing, hasn't it, Philip? I mean, I think people genuinely had a great respect for the Queen and, you know, I'm not going to go through all of the clichés again about what she represented and all those things, but I have found it quite staggering to see the extent to which, you know, politicians flocked to Her Madge like, moths to a flame over the last 2 weeks to make sure that they were identified as being there and mourning in a really conspicuous way.
I don't know whether you read the Tingle column in the Fin Review.
No, I try to avoid it.
Well, I do assiduously, and the writer thinks that the pomp and ceremony raises more questions than should we just become a republic.
Well, that sounds like a really good point, Philip. I think that there's this real complexity about this, isn't there? I mean, it's easy to just say, well, the Queen is dead, and we always said that once the Queen died, the Republic debate would take off. Well, that certainly hasn't happened as an initial cause and effect. In fact, it's gone the other way. But I think the thing that sort of strikes me about it is, there are several things that strike me about it. One of them is there's sort of this yawning chasm between all the symbolism associated with the Queen, separate from who she was as a person, and the Republican debate in the sense of it being seen as a change in our system of government. There's this sort of there's this spectacularly large grey area in the middle about what a head of state is in a symbolic sense, let alone in terms of shifting to having our own head of state, in terms of shifting the way the constitution might be structured or not changing the way it was structured. And I think also all this, even if you just think about the Queen in symbolic terms, it just became more and more striking to me as we watched that 2 weeks. By the time she was being escorted out of London on the gun carriage, she was surrounded by thousands and thousands of people in very splendid and sometimes silly military uniforms. And it tends to just be seen in a sort of, as a former Prime Minister, PJ Keating, would say, sort of theme park sort of way, as being about pomp and ceremony. But, you know, this is all about military, and you can see why, you know, a debate started but was often stomped on, not just here but in other parts of the world, about Britain's colonial legacy. Certainly its legacy of what was done in the name of the Crown historically in Australia.
Against Indigenous people.
And particularly for Indigenous people. And there was a piece very early on, I think within 24 or 36 hours of the Queen's death in, I think, the New York Times, which said, "Mourn the Queen, but not the colonial legacy of the Crown," and there was absolute outroar and outrage, about it around the world, that this was a disgraceful thing to be doing so close to her death. Now, whether that's the case or not, there's been a bit of a theme through the discourse since then that, you know, it was sort of a bit inappropriate or unsound to sort of talk about either the Republic or the implications and the impact that what was done in the name of the Crown, you know, has had a huge impact on our history and particularly on the history of Indigenous people in this country.
I can't think of an elegant segue here, but let's now talk about the Integrity Commission, which is sort of passing through the body politic like a pig in a boa constrictor.
I'm not quite sure what that means, Philip, but look,
well,
it's...
Legislation will be introduced this week.
So I'll let it go through to the keeper. But the... wait a minute. No, that's getting very confused in our metaphors. But look, it's really interesting. I mean, everybody's agreeing on having an anti-corruption commission, which looks like it'll actually have quite a lot of teeth. Now, we haven't seen the legislation for this yet, but... this is a really interesting political development, I think. You saw both sides of politics at various stages being very resistant to the idea of an anti-corruption commission, particularly the coalition, for a variety of reasons, that, you know, it might look like the New South Wales ICAC, that it might be mean to people, all sorts of things. They didn't do anything serious about it while they were in government. Labor pledged that it would. But the real push for this has come from the crossbench and from people who are advocates, whether they're judges or bodies who are interested in integrity in public office and public service. And essentially the signals that those people like Helen Haynes on the crossbench, who of course put in her own proposal for an anti-corruption commission in the last parliament, are saying, look, the signals we're getting from the government are that it will be a body with teeth, that it will have good safeguards, that it will be a better model than some of the state models have been, and they're pretty encouraged. And the coalition has come on board with this, and I think there is a scope for the parliament to actually work as parliament should and
let me ask you this.
The details of
will this, it have the ability to look at sins of the past, or will it only deal with cases of possible corruption now and in the future?
Philip, it will have the capacity to retrospectively look at sins of the past.
No wonder people are a bit anxious about it. What about budgetary independence, Laura?
We've got to see the details of that, but once again, we spoke to Helen Haynes tonight on 7:30. She's feeling pretty confident about that, that there'll be a structure put in place to make sure that the body has budgetary independence and that it will also be able to call its own inquiries. It won't be relying on references from the government of the day or even the parliament.
Now, of course, Dutton's a major player in this, and so let me remind you, beloved listeners, in parenthesis, if you want to know more about Peter and his views on the Integrity Commission, watch Four Corners on iView. It's a profile of the opposition leader. Laura, there was a statement to Parliament that has come out of the Royal Commission into Defence and Veteran Suicide.
Yes, this is, of course, the ongoing Royal Commission into Defence and Veteran Suicide, which is continuing to take evidence, Philip. But the Royal Commissioners felt a few months ago that they wanted to make some interim findings based on what had already been going on, which were really going to the mechanics of how the Department of Veterans Affairs works, and because it's so hopeless and you know, with the fact that we're losing more people to suicide than we lost in Afghanistan and Iraq is sort of pretty profoundly shocking. So the government has responded today to that interim set of recommendations. It's accepted most of them, and it's they are things like getting enough staff in place so that you can actually deal with claims that are coming in, trying to clean up a really messy sort of legislative and administrative structure which makes it very hard for people to actually get help. And it's also, the Royal Commission wanted to address things like the fact that parliamentary privilege has been seen to be a blockage to them actually being able to get access to some information. Now, this is one thing where the government has sort of not been quite so fulsome in its support of the recommendation, but it's basically said that it will do what it can to get around the problem that parliamentary privilege, ironically, creates in getting information to the Royal Commission, and is doing everything in its power to try to make sure that the Defence Forces are cooperating with the Royal Commission as best they can.
Now, in a minute and a half, Bill Shorten has made a significant announcement.
Yes, so Bill Shorten is the Minister for the NDIS, and he's announced a series of appointments today, including a new Chief Executive for the NDIA, which is the body that runs it. But he's also made a series of really interesting board appointments. Most sort of notably, I suppose, Kurt Fearnley, the Paralympian, is the chair of the body. He's got a lot of experience on boards. But also they're bringing in Graham Innes, who was involved right at the beginning with the Productivity Commission report that sort of looked at setting up the NDIS. There's somebody else who's really interesting, and I'm having a senior moment and forgetting who it is. But like, he's putting some very interesting people onto the board, and Dennis Napthine, who was the chair, was seen a bit as a political appointment. They've had a second thought. They're bringing him back into the board, but not as chair. So some interesting things are going to be happening, I think, in this space in the next few months.
One final thing: Optus yes, Optus no. The government's very cross with Optus.
As it should be, Philip, 10 million people have had their personal details compromised, including 2.8 million who've got things like their passport numbers and driver's licences revealed, and in a hack which the Home Affairs Minister says wasn't sophisticated, and, you know, in any other country, Optus will be facing fines of hundreds of millions of dollars. So you can see big changes coming through to the regulatory systems here once they sort out the mess that's been created by Optus.
Lovely to be talking to you again, Laura, and I'll speak to you down the track. Laura Tingle, Chief Political Correspondent, 7:30. This is LNL on RN, and now we're off to Brazil to talk to Sarah Maslin on the importance of the upcoming election. Brazil heading to the polls at the end of this week, and it's going to be a heavyweight match. The left-wing former president, Lula da Silva, is going head-to-head with the current president, the Trump of the tropics, Jair Bolsonaro. And there are signs that we might see Bolsonaro take another leaf from his American hero's playbook with one of those last-ditch power grabs if he loses the vote. To tell us more about these eventful elections, we're joined once more by The Economist's marvellous Brazil correspondent, Sarah Maslin. Sarah's on the line from São Paulo. Welcome back, Sarah. You're going to be a very busy journalist in the weeks ahead.
Indeed. I've been busy and will continue to be busy. It seems like during and even after the election, seems like Bolsonaro's definitely planning something if he loses. So I think none of us can really expect to have a break anytime soon.
Sarah, how will this election work? Clearly, there could be more than one round of voting.
Right. So the first round is on Sunday. And if neither of the leading candidates gets more than 50% of the vote, there'll be a runoff a month later.
What are the polls suggesting right now?
Well, Lula has been leading the polls this entire time, and he's leading by, you know, up to 10%. It's not impossible that he could win in the first round, although that seems to be unlikely. If he wins in the first round, it will be much harder for Bolsonaro to do what all of us think he's going to do, which is, you know, claim that the voting system is fraudulent, that the polls were wrong. He's been saying this the whole time. You can't trust the electronic voting machines. And it really looks like he's preparing to claim that, you know, whatever happens, he was really the winner. But that'll be much harder if Lula wins in the first round.
Well, as you pointed out previously, Brazil's electronic voting system is pretty well run.
That's right. It's been used in, you know, many, many elections. There's never been any, you know, claim of fraud that's been proven to have any weight to it. And indeed, it was this voting system that, you know, gave Bolsonaro his victory 4 years ago by, you know, quite a lot. And so it's kind of strange that he's now saying that you can't trust this very system.
We've seen modern elections get more and more expensive as all the combatants spend oodles of money. Is that the case in Brazil? Is there lots of advertising, lots of promotion, lots of social media?
Absolutely. And here in Brazil, you know, something that sort of changed recently is the Supreme Court made it illegal for corporate donations, which has meant that actually the response in Congress was to pass a law that increased the amount of public money that goes toward campaigns. So the campaigns get this huge chunk, millions of reais to spend on their campaigns from taxpayer money. They use that for TV, radio, ads every day, in addition to, you know, quite a lot on social media. And that's really Bolsonaro's strength, is social media. He usually does better on Twitter and Facebook and YouTube and so on than Lula.
So he hasn't been banned from Twitter like his hero in Washington.
No, he hasn't. Although, you know, like always, there's a whole lot of fake news. His supporters have been saying that Lula would close churches, would turn Brazil into a communist country and get rid of private property. And, you know, that he's really kind of riding on this good versus evil myth and painting Lula out as this crazy leftist.
I want to get back to that, the sort of Christian zealotry in just a moment, but we should remember that he's a former army captain. Will he have the support of the military and the cops?
Well, that's the big question here in Brazil, right? I mean, it looks like he's following the Trump playbook in planning to claim that something went wrong in the voting system, that there was fraud, that really he was the winner. Can't you see all these people coming out in support for him in his rallies? It's not possible that he couldn't win. But if he were to, you know, call his supporters into the streets and you get a situation like what happened in January 6th in the U.S., maybe, you know, taking to the electoral tribunal, invading it, or who knows? It's hard to predict exactly what angry people, you know, many of whom will have guns because he's made it easier for Brazilians to own guns would do, but we don't know what the military and the cops would do. Where, you know, everyone hopes that they would support democracy, but Brazil's only been a democracy since 1985.
Well, that's very important to emphasize, isn't it? It's a very young democracy.
Indeed, indeed. And Bolsonaro has, you know, filled his government with a lot of military folk, and, you know, military always says that it's in favor of democracy, but it also has insisted on being part of the, you know, the electoral tribunal's process of verifying the vote, and has raised some questions and seemed to even almost repeat what Bolsonaro has been saying about the system being vulnerable. So some of us really are wondering what their response will be if he claims that something is fishy about the result.
LNL on RN, and we're talking to the economist Sarah Maslin about Brazil's upcoming and fraught elections. Let's look at more detail at each of the candidates. You recently spoke to the contender. Tell me about his political history and what his current vision is for Brazil.
Well, Lula, you know, of course, was president for 8 years during a really fruitful and hopeful time for Brazil in the early 2000s. He benefited from a commodities boom, which really allowed him to put into practice his social policies, which brought a lot of Brazilians out of poverty. He's kind of hoping that Brazilians remember that time and assume that that's what he would be like again. He said that he would reintroduce, you know, programs to give cash transfers to people and expand social housing schemes and do a big infrastructure program to provide jobs, which he sees as the sort of way to boost growth, which has been really quite stagnant in Brazil. The question is whether he can actually do that. Conditions are a lot harder now than they were in 2003, both in Brazil and in the world, you know, in general.
But Sarah, we've got to look at the paradox of his time in power, because with all his noble intentions, his government was plagued by corruption scandals, and he spent a year and a half in the slammer.
That's also true. Lula's legacy was really tainted after he left office and prosecutors started investigating what here is known as Lava Jato, or car wash, this massive corruption scheme involving Petrobras, the state oil firm, state companies, private companies, and political parties, including his Workers' Party and people very close to Lula. He himself was investigated for accepting bribes, was convicted, and spent a year and a half in jail. Ultimately, the Supreme Court overturned his convictions on the grounds that partly that the judge who convicted him was biased and also a kind of technicality. But he was never, you know, officially, the evidence was never, you know, thrown out or said not to be valid. So Lula claims he's innocent, but there are a lot of Brazilians who really, you know, still think that he was part of this corruption and hasn't really, you know, owned up to it. To me, he basically said, we're sick of apologizing, but they've never really apologized for it.
Well, of course, Bolsonaro is more of a known quantity to the outside world at this point. So let's get back to the religiosity you were mentioning earlier. He's putting himself up as a crusader for Christ, effectively, versus the devil.
Yeah, and it's quite ironic because Bolsonaro, before he became president, was this low-level federal deputy known for, swearing and saying crude things about women. He talked about how he used his official apartment in Brasilia to host women. And, then he becomes president and now has held himself up as this family man who is here to save Brazil from the sort of specter of the return of a communist leader who would, turn Brazil into this big sin pool. Bolsonaro is hoping that this will really help him, especially with evangelicals, which is a big part of his base. He's also, though, trying to get the poor people to vote for him by increasing cash transfers. He's passed all sorts of subsidies. He's really stretching the budget and putting Brazil in quite a difficult fiscal position in order to try and buy his way. It doesn't seem to be working, though. I think, the real question for a lot of poor people who are a big share of the population here in Brazil is which of these two men, both of whom have been president, really have their interests in mind. And it seems like right now what they're saying is it's Lula.
Of course, the evangelical vote is as important in Brazil as it is in the U.S.
That's right. And one thing that, that we don't know, because there hasn't been a census since 2010, is exactly how many evangelicals there are. There are probably more than the, 21, 22, 23% that the census showed last time around. But if it's as much as a third, which some people are saying, then perhaps the polls are actually underestimating Bolsonaro's percentage, because there could be more evangelicals than we're all taking into account. So that's a big unknown.
Going back to another current election, and we're talking Italy, the surprising thing is not so much that a very, very right-wing woman is looking like winning, but that there was such a low voter turnout. What do you expect in Brazil? Are people busting to get to the ballot box?
Well, voting is mandatory here in Brazil, so most people will vote. That said, we've seen increasing voter abstention in recent years. I think in this case, it's going to be poor Brazilians who have to work, who find it hard to get to the voting booth. Most people have really strong feelings about this election. When you ask people, more people are decided on their vote a week from the election than in most elections up until now. There's very few undecided voters. That said, people, especially the poorest Brazilians, may not be able to make it to the polls. So we may see that number kind of higher than we expect, which could have an impact on the result.
The last time you and I talked, Brazil was smack bang in the middle of COVID, and people were really suffering as much in Brazil as anywhere else on earth. Can you tell us more about what the economic situation is in Brazil now and how that might play into the election?
It feels like a really long time ago now, but yes, Brazil had a really rough time during the pandemic, and it was made worse by Bolsonaro, who, took ages to buy vaccines and refused to take COVID seriously. That said, the economy has done better this year than people expected it to, partly because of high commodity prices, which have benefited Brazil, partly because of all of these subsidies and social spending that the president has done in the lead up to the election, which is sort of fueled consumption. However, inflation here is still really high, and that affects the poorest Brazilians the most. And so, even though perhaps GDP growth is going to be closer to 2% or even, slightly above 2%, poor people aren't feeling that. They're not feeling like, you know, suddenly their lives are a whole lot better. And so I think that, you know, there's still a lot of worry about what's going to happen to the economy going forward.
Now, the outcome of this election also has global consequences because Brazil, well, it's one of the world's biggest democracies. It's a major power in Latin America. And it controls over half of the Amazon.
Indeed. So this has, you know, been one of Bolsonaro's weakest points in his presidency, the thing that has received the most criticism, especially internationally. He has basically allowed deforestation in the Amazon to skyrocket, you know, and done very little about it because he sympathizes with a lot of the groups who are deforesting, the illegal miners and loggers and ranchers. Lula, on the other hand, when he was president, oversaw deforestation really kind of coming down because the government took seriously enforcement and trying to, you know, create systems, including with the international community donating money to find ways of sort of sustainable development in the Amazon that don't involve cutting down trees. And so I think, you know, one of the ways that we can measure these two candidates is also what each of them would mean for this huge rainforest that is increasingly and extremely important in stopping climate change. And it's pretty clear that Lula comes out ahead.
Okay, let's go back to the Trump of the tropics and imagine that he loses. But of course, like Trump, he's going to linger on, isn't he? He's still going to be a kingmaker.
I think this is something that a lot of people aren't really taking seriously enough. There's this sense that, oh, the Bolsonaro era, you know, could be coming to an end. And for people who don't like Bolsonaro, that's a huge relief. However, I think we've seen in the U.S. how even out of the presidency, the Trump era has absolutely not ended. And I think the same thing could continue here, especially if Bolsonaro manages to convince a lot of his supporters that actually he was the real winner and that he's, you know, been the victim of a massive fraud. If there is a chunk of the Brazilian population, you know, 20%, 25% who believe that and, you know, tell their politicians that they believe that, that could mean both a very polarized society, but also a Congress that is hesitant to completely back Lula if they're worried about what, you know, their voters are thinking. And so I think it's gonna be a kind of complicated scenario going forward, regardless of whether, you know, Bolsonaro tries to stay in power and how far he gets on that mission. There are gonna be a lot of people who still see him as the, you know, the real leader of Brazil, and Lula is going to really struggle to win those people over.
Sarah Maslin, you'll have to come back soon and talk again. The voice of Sarah Maslin, who is the Economist's Brazil correspondent. And now let us pay tribute to Hilary Mantel. So sad to hear about Hilary Mantel. Dame Hilary, of course, to her friend. She spent so much of her life in very intense pain, which seemed somehow to work wonders with her writing, which we saw most spectacularly with her Wolf Hall trilogy. It brought her tons of fame. She won not one, but two Booker Prizes. And as you know, the trilogy focused on the life of Thomas Cromwell rather than the more infamous King Henry. The books paint a great portrait of this self-made man who managed to get so close to power, and of course, the women who came and went from Henry's court. It was a privilege to speak to Hilary about the trilogy back in 2015, and I began by asking, as Tony Benn believes, if you can divide all politicians of any stripe into straight men, fixers and maddies.
I suppose, you know, the thing is with Thomas Cromwell, who's the centre of my Wolf Hall books, that he does cross categories. He appears to be guided by principles. he does have beliefs, but it's quite hard to pin him down at any one time and decide what they are. And he operates like a supreme pragmatist. That's his style. He's certainly the fixer par excellence. But I think part of the interest is that it's difficult to pin him down and put him into one category or another. Just when you think you've got him, he changes.
Now, he's the perfect figure of meritocracy for our age, as one of your admirers wrote, a survivor of childhood abuse, teenage tearaway, self-made man, but even he can't escape the power of entrenched privilege. That surely is his major appeal to us.
It situates him firmly in his time, because what he found difficult was to build up any constituency. You see, if it were now, he might have ordinary people behind him. But in those days, they regularly rioted in favour of their right to be governed by lords. They didn't back Cromwell because he was the man of the people. Quite the opposite. They thought that he was perverting the order of nature by rising so high. This was a very hierarchical society. It was unlike ours in that respect. And whereas we tend to applaud ambition, in those days, ambition was a dirty word.
In the series, he's played by Mark Rylance, and with a pretty much a poker-faced performance, which makes him all the more terrifying, calculating, awe-inspiring, unstoppable, and they're just his good qualities.
One of my ideas about Cromwell is that he presented people with a blank canvas and he was willing to absorb their projections of him. So if they said bad things about him, if they abused him, if they slandered him, he doesn't necessarily try to put them right. He just absorbs all those things because he's learning about his enemies by what they say about him. It's as if he's using their eyes as a mirror.
And to some extent, that blank face of his allows anyone to project their own feelings onto him, so even the young king becomes increasingly seduced by him.
Yes, you see, they project their fears, their wishes, and he absorbs it all. It's very interesting the way the balance is kept between those two men. The man with almost supreme power, which is Henry, and the man standing in the shadows, Cromwell.
Hilary, I'm wondering to what extent your revisionism on Cromwell has earned you the ire of the orthodox academic historian.
Well, of course, I am not breaking new ground. Thomas Cromwell's centrality was established 30 years ago by Geoffrey Elton, the greatest Tudor historian of his era. Many of today's working historians were Elton's pupils, and they had to react against him somewhat to make their own names, and that meant they reacted against Cromwell as well. But it was really Elton who broke the ground. Of course, he wasn't too interested in what kind of man Cromwell was. He defined his achievements. He stated his importance. But this is where novelists can begin to operate, because they do ask these questions.
Even though you acknowledge you're on, quote, marshy ground.
The marshy ground of interpretation, which I share with the academic historians and the popular historians. Nevertheless, I'm not making this stuff up, you know. It's just a question of going back to the sources and not agreeing to accept a bundle of prejudice passed on from one generation to the next. I think there's a divide, really, between Cromwell in academic history, where he's well known and much studied, and the way he's been represented in popular history and in fiction and in drama, where he's become very two-dimensional and he's been a sort of reach-me-down villain.
Well, quite a few people will be shocked when I suggest to them, and this is by no means an original observation, that there's something of the Gatsby about him. You know, there's a great mystery about his life. There's a big missing period in the middle of it. And once again, people projected onto Gatsby all sorts of fantasies.
Yes, I think that's true. Cromwell, in my books, he doesn't tell stories about himself. If he does, there's a purpose behind it. He's trying to manoeuvre something. He is concerned with his image, but in a way that is less obvious than for most people. He's highly manipulative, and he's a good psychologist. He's very observant. I'm taking this from life. These were the things that were observed about him. But he doesn't easily yield to interpretation, either by his contemporaries or by historians.
You've said that you were drawn to the story of Henry because of the women. Without the women, no story. But having said that, you've avoided turning the women into myths. As you say, you won't invent greatness where there isn't any.
Yes, I think for much of history, you know, the women are ciphers. They don't emerge as distinct personalities. They didn't have much agency. They didn't have much power. And that makes it very difficult, particularly for historical novelists, to realise them as characters. But when you're writing about Henry's reign, well, he happened to be married to two of the most intelligent and combative women of his time, first with Catherine of Aragon, then with Anne Boleyn. These are real personalities who act for themselves. They're not just ciphers, and they're not just pushed around by the men. So although they're not my main focus, it does make it a more interesting and appealing story for the modern reader.
There is one woman in it who reaches out and touches the heart, and that's, of course, his wife, Cromwell's wife, not Henry's. And that terrible scene, this is one where, you know, the facial expression does change, the terrible scene where he discovers that she's dead and also her daughters.
We don't know much about Elizabeth Cromwell. There's one letter from him to her, and it's just a little bread and butter letter. It's just a little business letter, really. It's about six lines long. That's all we have to go on. But I had to make a decision about this marriage. Obviously, in some senses, it was an arranged marriage, a business proposition. She was a fairly well-off widow when he married her. But I think they may have had high regard for each other, because after her death, he was so close to her family. They worked for him. They lived with him. He never cut his ties and moved on. He didn't marry again, which there could have been various reasons for. But we have scanty facts to go on there. And his daughters, you know, they're just names. They're there in his will. Anne and Grace.
Well, the scene is the scene of the deaths is enigmatic. You don't underline it, and you don't really even explain it. It just happens. But God, it packs a punch.
It packs more of a punch when it's actually shown on television than in the books, where it's fairly recessed, because I'm conscious that we don't know exactly when they died, or whether they died together, or how close to his wife's death. But I do know that it must have been devastating, the impact of those three losses. It left him with just his son Gregory, and all his hopes had to go there.
Now, the wonderful thing, or one of the wonderful things about Wolf Hall, is that, thank heavens, it's not written in turgid pseudo-Shakespearean, with pseudo-Shakespearean or biblical dialogue. We don't have to wade through the these and the thous. They're wonderfully accessible and colloquial. Big decision?
Not really. Natural decision, because you have to privilege clarity, accessibility. What it is, it's modern English, but with a twist. It sometimes echoes or shadows Tudor syntax. I sometimes use an odd word. What I have to do, you see, if I can get people's real words quoted with any authority, I try to use them. That means I have to smooth them into my own work so that you can't see the join. And if I can manage to do that, that for me is one of the best parts of writing historical fiction, feeling that you fused your idiom with yours. And what I hate is pastiche, and I hate parody. And your language mustn't attract attention to itself to the extent that it gets in the way of communication.
Now, the figures of Cromwell, of Henry, the wives, other figures like Thomas More, now he's a Maddie, he's unequivocally a Maddie, I would have thought, have parallel lives in the modern day. Lots of critics have compared your Cromwell to, well, Alistair Campbell, former chief strategist for Tony Blair. Was that part of the appeal for you in writing about them, that you could at least, that you could project their significance into our century, into our 21st century, and have it help our thought processes?
No, actually it wasn't. You know, I believe that the past was not a rehearsal for the present, and they were not us in some kind of unevolved form. I think the past is worth studying for its own sake. It's a piety to say we should learn from history, but you notice we never do. And when I'm writing about the 16th century, I really am writing about it. It's not a coded way of writing about the present. I write contemporary fiction, so I'm able to address it more directly if I want to. One doesn't, of course, deny the resonances, because back then, in Thomas Cromwell's day, that decade of the 1530s, it was defining, it reshaped the English nation. And that time in English history went on to have great consequences for other countries, other societies. And so I'm not denying its importance and that we can learn from it. But Cromwell is not standing in for Alistair Campbell or any other figure. I could write about them directly, but then you see, I'm not a journalist. What I value is the long view, and I value being able to get perspective on events. You may think, well, 500 years, that's a ridiculously long view, but I want to sort out what's ephemeral and what's enduring. And you can't always do that as a journalist. It's where the novelist has an advantage.
Look, I think you've also been well served by your televisual translators. What we have, yes, there's some pretty plush costumes, and it's about posh people, but it is astonishingly understated. It's all shot in close to natural light, so the interiors are candlelit and there's no additional lighting, and so a lot of it's murky, and you've really got to stare to make the characters out. When they walk out the door, it's like coming out of a cinema after a matinee. Yes. You're suddenly dazzled, you know, by the lighting, by the sunlight. But the performances have an understated quality. There's nothing tricksy about the direction. It is a very straightforward production.
I've been really privileged because Peter Kosminski as director, Peter Strawn as screenwriter, it was the dream team. Peter Strawn, so adroit, so quick, so instant in his grasp of the age and what mattered. And Peter Kosminski, not carrying, you know, any baggage from historical drama. He doesn't watch it. He's never made it before. But he is political to his fingertips. And he is a wonderful orchestrator of debate, because in his more contemporary political dramas, just as you think you've made up your mind which side you're on, he pulls the rug from under you. And he really engages the intellect as well as engaging the visual sense. And I think he's brought that to Wolf Hall as well, realizing that to these people, these debates were urgent, they were proximate, they were happening here and now. They didn't know their own story. And we have all the rippling multiple ironies that come with that distance. But they are just walking in the dark.
It's also surprising to people to realise how Henry was hampered, inhibited, even afraid in his own actions. He's constantly looking over his shoulder. He's worrying about who he can trust. He's not as audacious as one expects.
His reign was really, I wouldn't say blighted, but this question of having a son, having an heir, it did dominate proceedings. It wasn't some kind of vanity project, wanting a son. He saw it as crucial for securing the stability of the kingdom. You know, England had emerged from a period of corrosive civil war, and the ruling classes, it seems as if their hobby was just killing each other. The Tudors had brought some stability, they brought peace, but he certainly wasn't secure, and he was prepared to do almost anything, as history shows. Only a woman, but which woman, could give him a son? And it's not a question simply of personal feeling and romance. It's a profoundly political question, this matter of how can Henry breed.
You know, there's something about your writing, which another thing about it I like, and that is you observe, but you don't actually judge that often, do you? You look at these people with a lot of, well, acceptance, tolerance, even compassion.
I think it's important to respect your characters. I think that's the key to it. And not judge, because real wickedness is rare. Most people doing the best they can in the circumstances in which they find themselves. And, of course, I think in historical writing, it always appears that cause and effect flow together. And a historian tries to fathom motive and render it transparent. In life, of course, people often don't understand their own motives. And I think a novelist can bear that in mind, that they operate unconsciously as well as consciously and intentionally.
And that was Hilary Mantel talking to me back in 2015 on our next Asia Pirouette, and we'll be talking to Tam Hussein about his years of research into foreign fighters, particularly in the war in Syria, and we'll also introduce you to the work of Tasmanian painter Patricia Giles.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listener.